share personal experiences from their operations with emphasis on how to maximize inputs and stretch dollars as efficiently as possible. To moderate this panel, I'm pleased to introduce Kenneth Hood, a cotton grain producer and general from Gunnison, Mississippi. Kenneth also chairs the Beltwide Conference Steering Committee, which put together this excellent program over the past 2 days. Kenneth?
Thank you, Chuck, for the introduction. And I'm pleased to chair this morning's panel of innovative producers. And I think you'll see they go from far east as you can go into North Carolina all the way to Arizona. So we'll have a good medley of discussion here this morning in that. And I'll introduce them in order of their presentations and ask them to speak from their chairs. And time permitting, we may have time to have a question or two. But I promised Chuck I'd keep him on schedule, so that's what we'll do. Our first producer is David Grant, who farms cotton, peanuts, and grain in Garysburg, North Carolina. Following David will be John Lindemuth. John operates a cotton and grain operation in Tiptonville, Tennessee. From the Southwest region, we have Stacy Smith, and Stacy's from Wilson, Texas, and he raises cotton and grains also. Our final panelist is Steve Sossaman from Queen Creek, Arizona. And Steve raises cotton, grain crops on his operation also. So, David, let's begin with you.
Thank you.
Innovative. I don't know, I have a hard time sitting up here with a couple of my neighbors around because I'm not sure that they would think I was all that innovative. But when Craig called me and thought some of y'all might be interested in the little experiment we had up in our area. I'm up in northeastern North Carolina. I'm right on the Virginia line and right on Interstate 95. So we're about as far north as cotton is grown in the belt. And we were, I know if any of y'all were down in Pat O'Brien's last night, y'all would think I had the best cotton land in the world, but I'm gonna have to fess up now that the bright light's on me. We've got a fair amount of land, maybe 20% of the 30% of the land we own, of what we call marginal land. We're right on the break between the Piedmont and the coastal plain. When we get up in the rolling hills of the Piedmont, when you go west of my house, we start getting into a lot of red clay, a lot of gravel, a lot of rocks that we call marginal land. We call it, it's 600-pound cotton land. And we're sitting around, couple of friends of mine about this time last year sitting around going, well, it's just, we've had 4 years of beans on that land. We're really not making any money on it, but we can get by collecting the countercyclical payment. You know, what's going to happen when cotton goes up and we don't have a countercyclical payment? We can't plant, or we don't feel like we can afford to plant $500 a bag cotton seed on 600-pound cotton land. You know, and we're sitting around thinking with David Dunlow and Tim Phelps and myself are going, well, jeepers, we got four generations of farmers who've been making a living growing cotton on that land all their life. You would think that we could figure out a way to do it. So anyway, we started looking at the idea of planting some non-transgenic, regular old conventional cotton on that land. Well, first thing we did was find out the seed's not very readily available anymore. Not a whole lot of folks wanting to grow conventional cotton. So, but David Dunlow got on the internet and found a fella in Texas that was a seed breeder and found out we had some seed available from Seed Source. So then we got to talking about it and, you know, we were thinking, you know, can we make this work? And finally, you know, we went round and round for about 2 weeks, and finally Tim Phelps says, well, look, you know, we did it 15 years ago on all I acres. There's no reason in the world we can't grow 10, 15, 20% of I acres in conventional cotton and make it work. So we bit the bullet and ordered 5 or 6 pallets of seed, and between the three of us, we planted about 600 acres of cotton that had no technology in it. End up having about $15.60 an acre in the seed, which that's what really got our attention. we started running the numbers, and you look at 600-pound land, even with an 80% crop insurance, doesn't guarantee you but $300 an acre. And we started running our budgets through it, and you know, it looked like we could get to June 1st with not but a little bit over $200 an acre in that cotton. And that starts giving us a lot more leeway. You know, if we get to June 1st and find out that we didn't get a good stand, or we've had a hailstorm, or it hadn't had any rain and the drag's working on us, we can start pulling in the reins and hopefully not go over that $300 figure by the end of the year. Conversely, if the crop looks good, we can go ahead and put some more inputs in it, get the top dressing out, and try to make a crop. You know, when we run the numbers on Roundup Ready Flex, Bolgard 2, you know, we're over that $300 limit by the time June the 1st, June the 10th gets down. You know, that's just scary for us. So just to tell you a little bit about what we went through, the yield on the cotton was excellent. It yielded right along with, you know, we still were planting our Bolgard 2 Roundup Ready Flex cotton on all our good cotton land. But this enabled us to pick up our cotton acres by about 20%. We got an extra 600 acres of cotton land to go through the cotton gin. And we ended up making a good yield, like I said, so it worked out well for us. We were extremely fortunate in that all the prowl and cotteran that we put out got a rain on it. As Stanley was telling us yesterday, you know, we got rain on all of our residual herbicides and got them activated and got them working. And that made the rest of the year go fairly uneventfully. Like I said, we put prowl and cotteran out at planting. We came back fairly quickly with a slide lay-by rig, putting out some MSMA and staple. We ended up spot spraying it, you know, some with staple. We spot sprayed some other areas with MSMA. We ended up, I like to say spot spraying, but we ended up spraying almost all of it with one of the old grass herbicides over the top. And we ended up with a fairly clean crop. We were shocked. You know, I've never sprayed cotton more than twice for worms in my career. And we ended up spraying this three times. But that was mainly because we had we got an early infestation of stink bugs and had to go out about 5 or 6, 7 days earlier than we normally would to spray for stink bugs and aggravated our bollworm problem. And that's really about all we did different. I don't have the labor and I don't have the equipment to do all my cotton that way, but we can pick up some extra acres doing that way, and we're going to do it again this year. Next year, what are we going to do different? We're probably going to use Reflex instead of cotteran pre-plant, and that will give us the cotteran to come back with MSMA, so we won't have to, and that'll save our staple to use a little bit later in the year, as hopefully our plan of attack. And the cotton, to tell you, we got complacent because the cotton was so clean mid, late May, and we didn't automatically spray the dual on it. Well, we're going to spray that dual this year, whether there's any grass out there or not. Let's see, I don't know of anything else that I need to tell you, but I think, you know, we're all shocked and amazed with the interest that everybody around the belt has and how it worked for us and how it worked out. And it's not the end of the world. We can do it if we have to. Thank you.
As I look around the room, I see producers that are doing much more advanced work with Precision Ag than we're doing, and perhaps my comments are more directed to those of you that are thinking about getting into Precision Ag. We've been working with Precision Ag for a number of years, and what I'd like to do today is just tell you a little bit about our operation and how we got into it and what we're currently doing and what some of the considerations are for us to go forward. And hopefully, when I get through, you'll see that it doesn't. You don't have to be technically savvy or a computer whiz or invest a lot of money into this. Unlike when we started 15 years ago, there's a lot of support out there now. But we farm in Northwest Tennessee, along the Mississippi River. Our soils are various. They range from crevassy sands to heavy clays. We farm about 5,000 acres, with half of that being in cotton, the remainder in wheat, beans, and corn. Over the last 20 years, we've experimented with a lot of different production methods, row patterns, cropping systems, no-till, conventional, cover crops, flat and bedded ground, 30-inch row cotton, 30-inch row skip, and 38-inch row cotton. Currently, we're 90% no-till. We plant our cotton on 38-inch rows. About half of that's bedded, half of it's on the flat. Our corn and beans are planted on 19-inch rows. My definition of precision ag is any process that gives you the ability to manage your crops in a site-specific manner. It can be high-tech or low-tech, and it can be fairly expensive or reasonably inexpensive. We began in 95 with a fairly inexpensive low-tech approach. We started out by taking GPS-based soil samples, creating field boundaries, and overlaying that with USDA soil maps. We then created management zones or sampling zones based on topography, drainage, and soil types. We had no variable rate equipment, so we accomplished our variable rate lime and potash primarily, and we did this simply by using landmarks and changing the rates manually as we went through the field, or delivering different types of batches to the field and changing our rates that way. Fairly simple, low tech. The only real cost was the sampling involved. Significant cost savings in lime and fertilizer. We felt like we improved our yields by applying additional fertilizer where we needed it and less where we didn't need it. But the next step occurred in 2004, as I was at a meeting much like this and heard Kenneth Hood talking about end time. It is remote imagery, as most of you know, that senses the biomass of the plants. It's an old technology, been around for a long time, but had never been any real delivery system to make it usable. This was a web-based system, provided aerial imagery that was posted to a website, usually within about 24 hours. It represented seven different classes of growth. It allowed us to go to the field and do plant mapping and field observations in the various zones, at which time we could decide on treatments and request prescriptions and download those and send them to the applicator. The benefits of this process were that we were able to vary our rates of plant growth regulators and defoliants. We realized some cost savings, but more importantly, we had the confidence to apply much heavier rates where we needed them, and to cut our rates out where we didn't need them. We ended up with a much more uniform crop, easier management of insects and other inputs, and it provided for a once-over defoliation. Well, in 2005, the following year, we were trying to look for some other way to use the data we were collecting, and we wondered if there might be some correlation between the late season maps we had collected, images, and residual nitrogen. So we started the following year taking those late season maps and the seven zones and paring it down to three sampling zones. And after we planted the crop and it applied 25 units of pre-plant nitrogen, we tested for residual nitrogen, resulting in an application that varied anywhere from 40 to 90 units of nitrogen. the testing we developed with our soil consultants and with the lab. It took us a little trial and error to figure out exactly how to do it, but basically we take into account the nitrogen and the ammonia available and the percentages we think will release organic matter and come up with what we feel like is available to the plant throughout the year. We subtract that from our target rate of about 135 pounds and end up with what we want to apply in these different zones. To evaluate the effectiveness of this approach, we installed yield monitors in our pickers, and we compared our yield maps to our applications. We determined we were able to vary these nitrogen rates without adversely affecting our yields. The benefits that resulted were a reduction in our overall rates of nitrogen. Normally we apply about 90 units if we're just going to broadcast. We reduced our overall average rate to about 75 units, which is a 15 unit reduction, and at the current cost of nitrogen provided some pretty significant savings for us. But more importantly, it reduced the need to apply plant growth regulators in areas of the field that had previously experienced excessive or rank growth. And it provided for a much more uniform cutout. And I keep coming back to that, but that's critical. We saw that this year with the late crop, but we're in the very northern end of this production, and it's just important to us that we get a timely cutout and we're not having to defoliate and come back and do it again, that we can accomplish it all at one time. In 06, we added another layer of information. We started collecting various soil data. We decided to reevaluate our data management systems and refine our approach to developing our management zones. Currently, we're using various data primarily to establish the management zones. We feel like there's a high degree of consistency with the yield maps, and the various data, of course, doesn't change over time. It gives us something solid we can go back to, but we still look at it with an eye to the yield maps and imagery that we're collecting throughout the year for other purposes. The benefits that we're seeing currently are a reduction in cost and just a uniform growth pattern that allows for less inputs of other products. The plant growth regulators, we have cut out on our, we've stopped doing variable rate defoliations because we have a much more uniform crop instead of late developing areas and some early opening. It seems to all be maturing about the same time. And we just feel like it's really made a big difference in our production practices. I've talked mostly for the last few minutes about nitrogen management, but we're doing lime and plant growth regulators and potash. We vary a lot of different stuff, but it's just not that difficult. There are some considerations. There is some cost involved, time. Somebody's got to process the information. Somebody's got to develop a game plan based on it. But now there are crop consultants out there. The chemical dealers, the Helena's, UPS, Jimmy Sanders, all these have divisions within their companies that are devoted to collecting, managing, and evaluating the data. So there's the impediment to getting involved and getting started with this isn't there like it used to be. I have a lot of people ask me in the hallways or comment that they just don't have the time or the resources to dedicate to it. And it's true, somebody's got to have those time and resources, but it's certainly not me. I mean, I evaluate the data and I come up with a game plan, but I don't input it. I don't download it. I've got an employee that does that. We like to do things kind of in-house, keep our hands on it. But there's a lot of good platforms out there commercially that you can go to that people can do that for you. Some of the other considerations, you've got, there's subjective evaluation of data. You've got to look at the field history, other limiting factors, soil types, compaction, drainage, your yield potential. You know, these all affect how you're going to develop your management zones. The data management's a big issue. If you're going to invest in software and process this information in-house, then you need to think about who's going to be using it and what type of information you're going to want to, what you're going to do with it. There's a lot of good software currently available. I guess what I'm really trying to get across is that it's just not rocket science. You don't have to be a computer whiz, because I'm certainly not. I've got an employee who's had no experience in this, but was comfortable with computers and rolled his sleeves up and took on the project. But there's a lot of good support out there, and I'd encourage anybody that hasn't given it a try to try it. I think there's real potential to manage our inputs and cut our cost and to produce a more uniform crop.
Before I begin, I would like to thank the other panelists for not having a PowerPoint presentation today. Throughout the year, I had a very interesting before, during, and after series of photos on what I was going to talk about, and it fell directly into the row unit of a cotton harvester during the harvest season, so that elaborate photo panel became a series of microchips. We had a farm in our operation that about 6 years ago showed a dramatic decrease in yield. And like most people, we assumed it was a fertility issue, maybe water issues. And for those of you that don't know, we have sand issues in West Texas, and maybe it got sand burned. But what we found out was it was a population of reniform nematodes that came back too numerous to count. And that is not anything you want to hear. To give you an idea of what we were up against during that time frame, for 5 years, kind of a normal practice was up to 120 units of nitrogen, 5 to 7 pounds of timic per acre, and then we started applying 17 ounces of vidate over the top during the growing season. And that kind of input produced a 5-year average yield of 490 pounds per acre, which is just not economically feasible. This forced us into a grain rotation that we started to implement to try to lower the population of reniform nematodes. You never eliminate them, you just simply try to lower them. After that grain was harvested, we looked at the field a little bit differently. We didn't just simply say that we had a rotation. We looked at that field and tried to determine at what point in that field the population of nematodes might be the smallest. And it seemed logical that that would be directly on top of the old grain sorghum stubble, because that is a resistant plant. So we began a process of applying 250 pounds, roughly, of dry fertilizer blended in with a yellow herbicide, and we rolled that into a small bed onto a milo stalk that was left standing at 12 to 16 inches tall. We let that stand until approximately 3 to 4 weeks prior to planting. We came back and cut that milo stalk. And also during this process, we used a fertilizer coulter to apply another 32 units of nitrogen into that seed bed. Then the conservation disc on the planter clean off the remaining portion or large percentage of the remaining portion of that trash, roll it into a 40-inch furrow area, which helps us with wind and soil erosion. One thing that I think is very critical to this process is to put that fertility in the seed bed. As we all know, reniform nematodes are a root inhibitor. Therefore, if you have your fertility 20 inches away from that initial plant, the chances of that getting utilized are very small during the growing season. Another thing that we got away from conventional farming methods in this process, because it was my opinion that if you had larger populations blended in a field with smaller populations of reniform nematodes, conventional methods created a cross-contamination issue and it reduced the benefit that that rotation brought you. A lot of this, I think, is due to volunteer cotton, for one, and hostable weeds. If you look at most of the weeds, at least in our area, and I think it's the case across the United States, most weeds are hostable plants to reniform nematodes. So when you rotate a farm and then go back the following year and plant cotton into an area that might have had a weed problem, you basically have put that cotton back into a pressure situation and lost the benefit that you can see out of a crop rotation. I'll talk a little bit about the numbers. We've come full circle 1 year of this, and in that same area where previously we had a 490-pound yield, after this rotation this year, we produced 1,200 pounds per acre. It was a 145% increase in yield. It's roughly $383 increase in dollars per acre in gross revenue. So it leads to the conclusion that maybe sometimes the rotation method could be as important as the rotation itself. And finally, I'll touch on a couple of questions that I know would come up, and that's tolerant varieties that we have today in terms of nematode pressure. I had used tolerant varieties prior to this rotation process with very little results, and I think that's for one reason. All of my populations are too numerous to count. I haven't had the pleasure of having a number come back. It's always too numerous to count. So that's kind of like walking out the door every morning and getting hit in the head with a sledgehammer. You don't have a very productive day, and that inhibits these varieties from going to work until we get a resistant variety that I hope is in the near future. So and I will point out also that I did use one of the tolerant varieties in this crop rotation, and I think it helped tremendously because the population was initially reduced enough that I think this product could go to work for us and produce a better yield. So as producers, I think it's very important to keep an open dialogue with your seed dealer. Not only don't just decide if you have reniform nematodes or a nematode problem, get a handle on the numbers, because open communication promotes good relationships. And when you have a better expectation of what that product can provide for you, it leads to a better relationship and cuts out on some confusion. Because I'll point out, if your population numbers are extremely high, these varieties struggle. Anything struggles in what we have available to us today. And with that, I thank you. It's been a pleasure to participate in this panel, and I'll pass it to Steve.
Well, I feel a little bit like Liz Taylor's sixth husband. I know what I'm supposed to do. I just hope I can make it interesting. Well, we've been farming out there in Arizona. There, our family has been on the same ground for over 90 years. And so it's one of those things, you kind of have a sense of stewardship as you embark as a fourth generation going on this thing. And I've always thought of, embracing technology when it comes along. And the other issue we have in the desert is water, the lack of water, the expense of water. So as I've been farming on this all this time, it has always been the front of our minds. I learned from my forefathers that conserve water and use the least amount as possible. So when laser leveling came popular in the 70s, we saw how it was done, got our own unit, we laser leveled everything. That cut our water by over 30%. And that was like, okay, that's a great thing. And also, rotation is a huge important part of the way we operate out there. Luckily, where we are in Arizona, we have a lot of things to rotate. Cotton, barley, wheat, corn, alfalfa, even vegetables at times. So we're blessed to have a chance to rotate into many different crops and to find what those best crops are. The benefits, as everybody knows, is weed pressures, nematode problems, and also building of organic matter. That's another problem we have in the desert Southwest. Our soils are very sandy. It's very hot there. We don't get rain. Well, of course, we get rain whenever there's a cotton conference in Arizona. And then we get maybe 0.3 inch, which we think is a huge flood. Of course, people just left 5 inches and they don't know what we're talking about. But it's a big deal for us. So the next innovation that came along is drip irrigation. And as you all know, Howard Wirtz, Sendunce Farms, he's the grandfather, the grand poobah of drip irrigation in Arizona. And he's probably more famous outside of Arizona than in Arizona. But Howard and I have talked many times about drip irrigation, above ground drip, buried drip. And so what interests me most about that was the equipment used in the below ground drip system. And what it did is it forced you to stay in the same tracks throughout the season, throughout the different crops, because that buried drip line was in the ground, and you can't do a lot of operations with that in there. You can't rip and plow and disc and all those fun things that we love to do out there by depositing metal in your field and burning up a lot of tractor time and labor and diesel. We have to find other things to do with our time. So I thought, how can I adapt his equipment to furrow irrigation? And because that would do a couple things for me. Number one, it would force me to adopt technology, and I couldn't jump out of it very quickly if I was too scared to use it. So we plunged in, we started using it, and the immediate savings was time, labor, and fuel. Once you plant a crop, you cut the stalks, and then you use a root puller, which is a technology developed by Sundance, which just lifts that root out of the ground about 6 inches. Then use a wide bed disc. And that piece of equipment, it rips, discs, and rehips those beds in one tillage operation. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. But now you have all this residue on top of the ground. Well, is it a good thing or a bad thing? Well, for us, it was a great thing, because now all that the residue is on top of the ground, that's where your anaerobic bacteria are. It breaks down. And the funny thing is, our organic matter in the soil almost tripled. And over the next 5 to 8 years, that's one of the huge benefits we have. But then you're thinking, well, wait a minute, if I grow these different crops, I've had these different row spacings, one for grain, one for cotton, one for these other things, what do I do? And I said, well, we used to grow 40-inch cotton. Well, why was it 40 inches wide? Well, I think it's because when you used horses, the horses need 40 inches to go down a row. That's what somebody told me. Well, we're not using horses anymore. So anyway, I decided on a 34-inch row spacing. You know, 30 is perfect for corn, and 36 is a picker. And so we kind of had to fudge that way. But a 34 works great for grain and cotton and anything else that we want to grow out there. And there's been experimentations with other row spacings. And that's worked out pretty well for us. The things that have come about is our soil tilth is better. And of course, the ground we farm on is called monkey ground because a monkey could farm it. I'm sorry, guys. It's real easy. It's sandy loam, and you know, it's pretty darn easy to do that. A lot of sand at times. So we manage what we do have. We embrace the technology that's out there, and then manage it. Now I know that the glyphosate-resistant crops or weeds has been an issue. But as Jimmy Webb mentioned before and a few other speakers, you keep rotating your chemistries, and we haven't had a problem out there. We also rotate our chemistries when it comes to insects. We've learned that over the years. You just don't go to one and stay with that one because it'll bring up issues. And as been said before, we're going back to non-transgenic varieties. Arizona has been part of the pink bollworm eradication program. And within another year, we believe that we'll be totally eradicated with pink bollworm. And we have been developing varieties in Arizona without transgenic, just for that purpose, just to get away. Anybody bought a bag of corn or cottonseed lately? Oh my gosh. So we understand the cost of that technology. But if we can get away from that, it'd be great. I just would encourage anybody out there, embrace technology. If it's available, use it. Try a little bit, don't go whole hog. But like you did, 200 acres, you know, I thought that was awesome to go back and do that. You know, you're not gonna get burned too bad, but you know what? You're gonna learn a lot in the process. And that's what I like to do, is learn through this process, the precision farming, and I think it's you know, try a little bit of it and see how it works. And I thank you very much.
Well, I certainly want to thank the panelists for the discussion, and we've got 2 or 3 minutes, so if anybody in the audience has a question, be thinking about it. At first, I'm going to give the panelists an opportunity to maybe ask each other a question if somebody has a burning issue they'd like to ask someone. So
I'd like to ask a question about the non-transgenic, and what was your game plan at the very beginning of the season? That's going to be what was the biggest departure that you knew you were going to have to do when you grew that?
You know, our first key was to get the yellow herbicide and the cotyledone and get rain on it before it evaporated or went away. You know, if we didn't get rain within 4 or 5 days, especially on the prior, the cotyledone lay there a little while, then we got an uphill battle to go all year long. But fortunately, we ended up, between the three of us, this cotton got planted over about a 2-week period, but all of it got a rain within 2 days of having the prior and cotyledone on it. And that made the job a lot easier from then on out.
Okay, thanks.
Have you had any discussions with seed companies as to availability of non-transgenics, especially up in your area where you need short season varieties and?
Well, no, we really haven't. Delta Pines, you know, has a pretty good variety, 393, that they think might have a little bit of availability of next year, but we were really happy with the seed source varieties that we had this year. And he's going to have enough available for us to plant what we want next year.